If I could just start off with a couple of questions to the speakers. Thank you. Thank you both. Mehdi, if I could just clarify a point you made, if I understood it correctly. I understood from your presentation that this kind of cult of the Mahdi, if you will, is very popular as a form of, you know, popular religion among the common folk. But I got the impression from what, if I understood you correctly, that Ahmadinejad's attempted instrumentalist use of this kind of modest narrative has been, you know, is ridiculed and rejected. It is popular as a form of a popular religion, folk religion, but not as his attempts to use it have just simply isolated him and have not really resonated with the masses, if I understood you correctly. I also wanted to ask Jean-Pierre if I could ask, first of all, if you could also tell us a little bit of what does this all mean? Where is this coming from? Is it also due to social distress, the growing popularity of modest discourse in the Arab world? Has there been also pushback in the Arab world by mainstream clerics and institutions against this kind of discourse? And finally, what are the policy implications of the growth of modest discourse in the Arab world?
I answer from
yeah, wherever you want. See if this works.
Is it working? Yes. So I don't know.
Okay, why don't you?
So, it's very personally, I don't think there is a social movement behind it, but I have the data. The empiric data are very hard to find. You know, in Iran, you can always see on the cover of any book what is the numbers of copies. If it is a second edition, third edition, fourth edition, it's impossible in the Arab world. You never know how many copies have sold of anything. So you see them, you see the impact, and you can hear it, see it on TV, but it's very difficult to have accurate data. Personally, I think all this is very much connected with globalization. That the idea of giving some meaning to it's not so much about distress, but it's very much about compensation. The idea that maybe we are now, because one of the main traditions is to say that before the end of time, Islam would be at the lowest, at its most destitute, in its most destitute situation. So a lot of people have the feeling that this is the case, and therefore compensate by getting into this kind of literature. When it comes to policy orientation, well, it's very difficult to tailor, because as I tried to describe, when the there's something very clear in what Mahdi said, and that I stressed also, this is basically an anti-clerical movement. Because this is to say to the religious establishment everywhere, you're wrong, you have been misleading us, your interpretation of the sacred text is not valid, we want something that is really giving immediate answers to our questions. So for most of the people, it will stay pretty compensatory, it will just give credits to their rejection of religious establishment. But a very tiny minority may be able to go further and to take it literally. And so far, as I told you, I saw that only in very limited circle on the margins of Al-Qaeda and in this militia in Iraq. But nobody had seen Juhayman coming.
Thank you. I've got a list of questioners here. You could either use the mic on your table, or there's a mic at the back of the room. I'm starting with Maury. And please also identify yourself before you ask your question. Thank you. Okay. Maybe you could, if
I
you
use my command.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. Speak loud.
It's on.
I'm more an amateur with the Jewish Institute to keep the imam well hidden. my question is, people like Rafsanjani and Khatami, have they spoken on this issue at all? Have they made their views known?
Rafsanjani, I can name them. Rafsanjani, Khatami, Dr. Hassan Rouhani, who was the top nuclear negotiator, Akbar Natiq Nouri, who is the former speaker of the Majlis, and many prominent clerics, they made it clear that this is a dangerous religious trend. It has nothing to do with Islam. It has nothing to do with Shia, because according to Shia tradition, everybody who claims that I have relationship with hidden imam, you have to say that he's a lawyer.
A liar, not a lawyer.
Lawyer.
Or a lawyer?
No.
Even worse if he's a lawyer.
Yeah. No, he's lying. Nobody, even if somebody see a hidden imam, he's in his dream, he's not allowed to tell it to anybody else. So nobody is allowed to get any credit through hidden imam. So hidden imam is hidden, and it is the God will to hide him until God decides to bring him back. So it's very clear. On the other hand, I just want to tell a story which helps to understand what Jean-Pierre said better. It's not only the religious issue. They are it's a big challenge for clerical authority. You know that in Iran, women are not allowed to go to a sport stadium to watch football. Only men can go there. In a speech, Ahmadinejad was asked why women are not allowed to go in the stadium. Ahmadinejad said, okay, what's the problem? Yeah, they can go too. No problem. It was perceived as a religious fatwa. Ahmadinejad is issuing a fatwa allowing women to go to the stadium. All clerics, they got upset. Who are you? You are not a religious man. You have not any sort of credential for issuing a fatwa. Then, after this big dispute, Ahmadinejad did not give up. This was Ayatollah Khamenei who intervened and said, okay, clerics are right. Ahmadinejad never said, I'm wrong. And the deputy of Ahmadinejad, in his public speech, said that, thank God, he's going to bring hidden imam. And the first thing hidden imam will do is to behead ulama and clerics.
Peter Gubser.
Peter Gubser. A fascinating discussion.
Thank you. Peter Gubser, a fascinating discussion. I have a question for Mr. Khalaji. When somebody says they're speaking to the hidden imam and then passes the message on, what's the content of the message? Is it primarily religious, social, economic, political, all of the above, none of the above?
Masjid, a mosque. Yes, it can be different things. There is no report that hidden imam said anything political and social to anybody until several years ago. Since Ahmadinejad came to power, some people claim that, yes, they have seen hidden imam, and hidden imam said, I support Ahmadinejad. Or people said, don't vote to reformist. Hidden imam said, don't vote to reformists. Reformists are not right people. We haven't had such things before Ahmadinejad. The messages of hidden imam throughout the history was always personal messages. And just praying, don't be sad, your problems will be solved, and, you know, just some sort of grief, that's it. But now we see that, and I have to add that nobody dare to publicly say that hidden imam, what hidden imam said to me. They just say, okay, we have some relationship. Once Ahmadinejad himself that I'm in touch with him. That's it. You know, he never said that, okay, what are the guidance I get from him or anything more.
I guess the thing is in Iran, correspondences between the president and the hidden imam are still considered privileged, whereas in Israel, messages in the Western Wall from U.S. presidential candidates get published in the Israeli press. So that's a...
Well, thank you. This is Tulin Dalodu with the Washington Times. Amongst the many great examples that you have given of the YouTube, Hollywood, and Broadway, I recall one of the interviews with Ashley Judd, who is a well-known actress. And she said that religion is for people who fear hell, and spirituality is for people who have been there. As you describe, that many Iranians feel like that they have been there. So I, you know, wonder, as you are, you know, describing of this new momentum that they have, that they are very much anti-clerical, and that there is a new definition or recomposition of religion within the Iranian society. Can you explain what it is now, how that recomposition is shaping and showing its face? Thank you.
Please jump here.
No. Look, as I said, they don't have any theological training, and most of them are coming from universities, like Ahmadinejad himself. So I always said that the Islamic fundamentalism has nothing to do with clerics and traditional institutes. Islamic fundamentalism is the product of the universities. And people who are educated at from the universities, we are facing doctors and engineers rather than clerics. These people, they don't, at least Ahmadinejad people, they don't have any book, any public discussion. They are. It seems that they are mostly active in this regard in their secret society or secret circles, rather than public. You know, in public, they don't say anything different than what clerics said. You know, they just say that imam, a hidden imam exists, and hidden imam will come back, and we have to be prepared. And that this sort of general, you know, statements, you don't see any fundamental difference between their public writings and what clerics say about hidden imam. One of the reasons behind this is that they are ignorant. They cannot challenge the theological system. They cannot write anything publicly because they cannot read the religious texts. They cannot read Quran. They are ignorant about the interpretation and exegesis of Quran. So they are mostly affected by Western ideology, as I said, like Heidegger and other people, rather than, you know, Islamic tradition. So the problem when I was doing this paper, it was very difficult for me to find out sources in which they explain their beliefs. No, you cannot find it. The only thing we have is their political speeches, you know, and some sources, some people who are, you know, they have inside information. That's it.
If I could just add on just one quick question for Jean-Pierre, because to what degree is there, do you see, I mean, you talked about kind of like the, in a way, the syncretistic kind of, you know, formation of
of Sunni apocalyptic thought and the influence of for Christian and Western ideologies on it, but to what degree is it also a response to things going on in Iran, or do you see kind of cross, maybe not cross fertilization is not the right word, but kind of that as a result of developments in Iran or Iraq, it then causes other people elsewhere. Can you actually see kind of a domino effect, if you will, for lack of a better word, in the way that this thought system is kind of spreading?
What is certain is that in the most, so it's working, in the most radical circles on both sides, of course, you have the opposite interpretation. For example, there is, I didn't go into it, a very heinous figure in the Shia narrative called the Sufyani, and they identify in the most radical circles Zarqawi. In the most radical centers, circles in Iraq, they identify Zarqawi with the Sufyani. While, of course, Zarqawi is identifying his followers in Iraq, they say that Jaish al-Mahdi, the Mahdi's army, is in fact the Antichrist army, Jaish al-Dajjal. So you have that. But what I found, and it's interesting that I found it outside of Iran, but it was still at the Iranian Cultural Center in Damascus, is a very coherent booklet published in Lebanon, distributed in Hezbollah-controlled area, where you have the whole apocalyptic cast. Nasrallah is al-Yemeni, so he's the vanguard. Ahmadinejad is Shoaib ibn Saleh, so he's the chief of staff of the Mahdi. And Khamenei is al-Khorasani, he's from Meshed, Khorasan. So he's a standard bearer of this. I'm sure that this kind of literature could not be distributed in Iran, because and in fact, they are so candid or so mischievous, I don't know, I think it's the same, because they say that they have a problem, because they have the whole... the thing with apocalyptic people is that they have a calendar. So you have to go through the calendar. It's impossible to, because it's written. So I have a problem because the Sufyan is supposed to take power in Damascus. So I have a problem because they have Bashar al-Assad in Damascus. So they published and it's distributed in Damascus. And they say that there will be a CIA and Mossad coup. It's important, otherwise it doesn't fit, So the Sufyani will be backed by the CIA and the Mossad and take power in Damascus. Not for long, they put it, not for long. So the forces of good will take over, and then the whole scenario will move forward. But it's still so... it's more than syncretic. It's basically heterogeneous. It's taken with so many different material, which is why it is so, I don't think it could have existed before globalization, before the spread of very different materials that were amalgamated into this very strange production, that my intuition, and that there is not much future for this line of thought. But better to be aware that it exists and that some politicians are using it and maybe betting on it at one moment or another.
Rafi Danziger from APAC. My question is to do with the power relationship between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei, where, as you described, the personal relationship is somewhat less than cordial. And yet, with few exceptions, some of which you named, Khamenei lets Ahmadinejad say what he wants to say and do what he wants to do. And I've heard two schools of thought about it. One says that the reason is simply because Khamenei basically supports the policies and positions of Ahmadinejad, that's why he supports. And the other is that actually Khamenei, while he's supreme leader officially, is getting old and weak, and Ahmadinejad is emerging, actually is a potentially stronger than Khamenei. What do you stand on that? Who do you think really calls the shots on those issues?
In terms of health, it seems that Ahmadinejad is sick and Khamenei is very healthy. But Regarding the relationship, look, Ayatollah Khamenei wants to be a powerful supreme leader. And a powerful supreme leader cannot be a powerful supreme leader with a powerful president. So his preference is a weak president. He cannot live with strong president, whether bureaucrat, reformist, radical, doesn't matter. So he has his own mechanisms to weaken the president and take the full control, have the full control over the executive power indirectly and other branches of the government. So he has the final say on any fundamental issues, domestic and foreign policy. Ahmadinejad, like Khatami, like Rafsanjani, the first 2 years of his presidency, he, you know, seemed to be very powerful, and that was scary. It doesn't matter that you are thinking as I think, or you are in my camp, or you are not from my camp. The sky of Iranian politics should have one star, and the star has to be Khamenei. Like Rafsanjani, who was very powerful in his first 2 years, like Khatami, who was very powerful in his two first years, and like Ahmadinejad himself, Khamenei, after a while, tries to somehow weaken the president. And that's what he did now. Ahmadinejad is the weakest president in the history of Islamic Republic, if we just exclude Bani Sa'd, the first president. Comparing to Khamenei when he was president, comparing to Rafsanjani, comparing to Khatami, he has lost his popularity. He has tremendous economic problems when Iran got lots of money from oil revenue. In terms of cultural, he's the most hated figure for intellectuals and producers of cultural productions, for artists, for writers, for musicians, for everybody. Because he almost shut down the culture in the country. There is no music concert, there is no movie, nothing. So, and the Majlis, the parliament, is very tough on him. You know that the next week they're going to discuss about his Minister of Interior, and most probably they're going to dismiss him. And that would create a big problem for Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad has changed his ministers, has changed 9 of his ministers, and this is not something that you can find it in any previous cabinets. So Khamenei look at him as somebody who is weak, and my speculation is that he wouldn't be re-elected in next presidential election, because Khamenei cannot rely on him. Clerics are very upset about Ahmadinejad. Khamenei does not want to harm his image by supporting Ahmadinejad. But the problem is, inside the country, if Khamenei does not support Ahmadinejad, Ahmadinejad will collapse, because everybody is against him. Everybody is against Ahmadinejad. Conservatives, reformists, bureaucrats, everybody inside the government, outside the government, nobody supports Ahmadinejad. Even the minister, some of ministers of Ahmadinejad who are indirectly appointed by Khamenei, they are against Ahmadinejad. So that's why Khamenei has to support him, because he doesn't want his cabinet to be fallen down. It would be very bad for the image of Islamic Republic. He wants him to keep continuing and going to the end of the term, and then...
And then we have in the middle, and this is our next one.
Yeah. Are you Hillel also?
Yeah, I'm Hillel.
Oh, we're two Hillels. Which Hillel are you?
Weinberg.
Yeah. All right. Hillel Weinberg. So my question, that's very funny, actually. Doesn't happen very often.
It's a function of the apocalyptic age.
I actually thought that you were going to say in the context of the football, of the soccer matches, that the hidden imam was going to decide not whether women could appear at could go to soccer matches, but in any event, rather than just behead the ulama. But in any event, what do the powers that be, as you've outlined them in Iran, say and do, if we know, about the Mehdist trend in Iraq, in Shia Iraq? What do they think about the Jaish-e Mahdi, for example, of Muqtada Sadr?
You mean ordinary people or the government?
I'm sorry?
You mean what?
What does the government? The people with the money and the guns. What are they doing?
Look, Iranian people, they don't care about their neighbors. Ordinary people, they don't know anything about them. That's the sad truth about Iranian people. They are most interested in knowing what's going on the streets of New York rather than knowing what's going on in Turkey or Iraq or Pakistan. So people, they don't know even that, ordinary people don't know even Mahdist trends exist in Iraq, mostly because they speak Farsi and they are not able to read Arabic or they are not able to communicate with Iraqi people. So the only thing they know, the only source of information is the state media. And they are fed up with this sort of crisis in the region. They don't pay. Every news segment on the Iranian TV start with a news about Palestinians. It's very rare if you watch Iranian TV and see that, okay, the news segment is not started with, hasn't started with news about Palestinian. Four Palestinians were killed, blah, blah, blah. They are fed up with Palestinians, with Iraqi, Afghan people, and they are not really interested in this sort of news. So, look, in a poll, Iranian people were asked whether they know that people in Tajikistan, what language they speak. 80% of Iranians don't know that the people in Tajikistan speak Farsi. So that's the situation. But the government is different. Muqtada Sadr, you know that he was, I think he's still in Qom. He was in Qom recently, and he pretends that he is studying theology. Iraqi clerics in Qom are very powerful because of Mahmoud Hashemi Shahrudi. Mahmoud Hashemi Shahrudi now, he is the head of judiciary. He is very close to Ayatollah Khamenei. But before, he was the head of the same party that now Abdul Aziz Hakim leads it. What do you call it in English? He was the head of this party, and then he became the spokesman of this party. And he is Iraqi, but he has Iraqi passport and Iranian passport. But he's the disciple of Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was in Najaf for a long time, and when he came Qom, 2-3 years after revolution, he was not able to speak Farsi at all. He started learning Farsi, and he had around him a great amount of Iraqi clerics were studying with him, working at Badr Army, or were involved in politics and different sorts of issues. So in Qom, there are different huge buildings just for Iraqi clerics, and they get money from indirectly from Iranian government, but from some other clerics like Mahmoud Hashemi Shahroudi, Sayyid Kazem Ha'eri, who was disciple of Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr too. So they have good position in Qom, and they are supported in different way. And even Muqtada al-Sadr people, they have houses, they have madrasa, they have money, they have everything. And I don't know how could be the relationship of this sort of, you know, Mahdi's trend in Iraq with clerics in Qom. I don't think that the Mahdi's trend can have any, influence inside the Qom seminary. Because as Jean-Pierre said, and I also mentioned, the Mahdi's trend are basically anti-clerical. They are trying to be a hypocrite. You know, they don't reveal their Mahdi's beliefs in Qom. They just get money and support and different sorts of, you know, political and financial support without highlighting this aspect of their identity.
Jean-Pierre, do you have anything to say about how the Mahdist trend in Iraq amongst, say, Jaish-e Mahdi views looks at the Mahdist trend in Iran? Or relates to it?
Well, I just have two points. Now that Jaish al-Mahdi is officially suspended, waiting for the right moment to emerge back, it was fascinating to see during the last anniversary of the Mahdi, which is the 15th of Sha'ban, that Muqtada, probably from Iran, asked his followers to renew their pledge of allegiance to the Mahdi and to use blood. Renew this pledge of allegiance.
Oh, sorry. And to use blood to renew this pledge of allegiance. So this has nothing to do with Islam and everything to do with Iraqi tribal pride. So we're talking about something very Iraqi and not Islamic or Shiite at all. And when it comes to the apocalyptic militia of Ansar Imam al-Mahdi, they are strongly anti-Iranian. They made already trouble when they were in the refugee camp in Iran. They are heavily anti-Iranian, and it's again a long tradition in southern Iraq of anti-Iranian, anti-Farsi xenophobia with a lot of Mahdist dimension.
So. Now, we had a few questions in the middle. Can you raise your hand if those of you who had wanted to ask? Okay, we have two. I'll take both of you guys together, and then we have Hassan at the end.
Okay. Can I?
One and two, yeah.
All right.
Just ask them in sequence.
Okay. Hillel Fradkin of the Hudson Institute. My question is for Professor Filou. If I recall correctly, you referred to David Cook's work, and one of the accounts he gives of this eclecticism, or I think Michael referred to it as syncretism, is that the old tradition really was formed in the era of the struggle with Byzantium, and therefore really needs to be updated. And one of the ways in which they got to the Bermuda Triangle was the old story that the Dajjal would be held in chains on an island someplace, but now they've run out of islands, so that they have to find a place for him to be. There's this, which points to this sort of dynamic of trying somehow to account for contemporary events in a way that's consistent with the spirit of the whole business. And in that connection, I wanted to ask you about one specific event and whether they've tried to make sense out of it. And that was the revolt and siege in Mecca of Juhayman al-Utaybi. There was a specific policy objective, so to speak, or a practical objective. They expected somehow or other to launch the Messianic Age. Failed. Is this an event for the apocalyptic literature and its attempt to interpret what's going on, or is it just absolutely out of the picture?
And the second question before we get a response. Yes, thank you.
Thank you. I'm just wondering if the wife of the hidden imam happens to know where he is. My question is, Christian apocalyptic literature deals a lot with the signs of the second coming, among them being the reestablishment of Israel, etc. And if you ask them, they can point a list to you. Is there something comparable in Islam? Are there signs that are sort of universally accepted?
And I'll tell you what, we'll take this. This will be the last one.
Hasan Hazar, Türkiye diyelim.
Louder.
Yeah. Sorry. In Islamic world, they generally believed that there is a big British influence on religious, non-related traditional Islam. But you told that there is a big German influence on Iran's youth and educated people. So is that a coincidence, or what are the reasons for this German influence on Iran's religious life? Thank you.
Jean-Pierre, you want to start? And then
yes. You know, the problem with Mahdist movement is that it's a one-shot deal. Because if you're really a Mahdist and if your Mahdi get killed, then it's over. Game is over. So you cannot establish a tradition of previous Mahdis, because if they are failed Mahdis, then they are wrong Mahdis. So it's very difficult. But this movement was interesting because there was, I think, from what colleagues gathered from interviews with survivors, there was a candid side to it and there was an opportunistic side to it. The opportunistic side was obviously Juhayman al-Rotaibi's side, because he saw his own brother-in-law, the Mahdi, being killed, and he didn't stop the movement. While any, if I may say, true Mahdist, if your Mahdi is killed, then it's over. And he went on. But you had a lot of, and this is also, you have nothing universally accepted when it comes to the sign of the times. You have different traditions, some with the most classical tradition in the Sunni is with 10 signs, the most classical in Shiism is with 5 signs, but then you can add a lot of minor signs. So I have books with 173 minor signs, and they keep adding it up because they are afraid of going up to the major signs, because that means that the countdown is starting, and this is a big responsibility. And by the way, as Mahdi's put, it could bring you a lot of trouble with the religious authority, because if you don't have the credentials to decide that the countdown has started. So you have that, and that is really interesting to see how it works and how it is conflicting. So for example, to come back to Mecca, you have, in fact, they were sticking to a certain collection of traditions from Abu Dawud, where you have the Mahdi. He was a traditionist of the 9th century. He one of the very few, wrote a Mahdi's book in his collection of tradition. So first you have the Pledge of Allegiance between the Kaaba and the Abraham station. But then the next step, because it's the next tradition, is that you have an army from the north. So it's known, it's documented. They all had transistors at that time, you know, and they were waiting for news from the army from the north, because it was written. And they were really disappointed, because, well, so they say, of course, it has been suppressed. The army from the north is sent, but they don't want us to know. So, and you have always this overlapping of, if I may say, candid apocalypticism and messianic populism in this kind of movement. Thank you.
The question of Germans' influence. Look, actually, everything in the history is accidental. This guy, Dr. Ahmad Faradi, this philosopher, was spreading the idea of the compatible, the Heidegger, which is compatible with Islam, 2 decades before revolution. And he could not imagine that such a revolution would take place in Iran. So it was complete. But the fact is that Fardid was very powerful. He was the first one who introduced Heidegger to Iranians, and you know that Heidegger is one of the most important philosophers of 20th century. So, and many Iranian secular intellectuals were his disciples. But after revolution, he became suddenly pro-Khomeini, and suddenly he declared that I want my philosophy to serve the revolution. His story is very similar to the story of Martin Heidegger himself.
Well, I see the sign that we've reached our end of time, so I want to thank you both for a fascinating presentation, and I guess we'll have to have meetings every even-numbered years from now on. So thank you very much.